multivitamins are miracle makers, but just to kind of ensure that if my diet is kind of crappy one week, I get everything that I end up needing in the end. So I wouldn't suggest that you do away with it, but I'd be very cautious about, you know, looking into research papers that kind of suggest that it's actually effective.
Oh, yeah, okay, fine business. I appreciate that, Roy. Yeah, over the years, I've taken it for about 15, 20 years, and it's from this company called Immune Tech, and they say they've done research on it and everything, but it's their product, of course. It seems to work. I mean, as far as any colds or anything, I very rarely come down with anything. Even when I had a touch of COVID, I was able to fight it off. But I did take the Paxil bit or whatever it was, and it knocked it out 1, 2, 3. But it seems work. It tastes pretty nice, so I can't complain. And as I say, I've taken it for a while. Well, what they say is that they are giving you the precursors, the stuff that lets your body generate the increased glutathione levels in your blood to boost your immune system, rather than actually giving you glutathione directly. So, as I say, it does no harm, and it tastes pretty good. So, okay, thanks, Roy. I appreciate it.
No problem. I mean, basically, it's made from 3 amino acids. It's made from glycine, cysteine, and glutamic acid. So they're giving you amino acid supplements with the idea that your body is going to be real nice about it and use it to only make glutathione rather than all the other proteins that are made from that. So, you know, even if it's a placebo effect, if the cost is low, placebo effects can be beneficial.
Oh, yeah, I have a lot of faith in placebo effects. That's a whole other study in itself that really needs to be investigated, but I think we could do another whole TechNet on that all by itself. Anyway, so a fine business. Thanks, Roy.
Brian?
Yes, Brian?
Besides the soybean, is there any other bean that contains complete amino acid profile?
I'm not 100% sure soybean has all the amino acids in it. I mean, are you sure?
That's what I've heard. I just wanted to go ahead and see if the soybean was the only bean, okay, that had all the amino acids instead of just some. And I'm going to research that out because I just want to find out from my own curiosity. Are there other beans that also have a complete profile with all the amino acids necessary?
Okay. I mean, I've never seen anything on the subject. You realize that, I mean, there are some amino acids we can actually produce. There's some amino acids that we've genetically lost the ability to manufacture in our cells. But we don't need all the amino acids. We just need the essential amino acids, and we can cobble together the other ones by ourselves.
No, good point, good point. It's which are the other beans, let's say, that do have all those essential amino acids that are complete natively.
Okay, something else to look up. In general, it's always a healthy practice to vary your diet anyway. You shouldn't kind of, you know, just kind of live on soy. I'll take a look. But again, I'd be surprised to find out that there's something that magical about soybeans as opposed to any other, plant product having a different, significantly different protein amino acid assay.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
while back I was doing some research, and I found out that apparently it's acknowledged that the only plant product that you can actually survive on eating just that plant product is quinoa. There's no other plant product that has a wide enough assortment of nutrients that you can actually survive on eating only that. I don't know if that answers the question at all, but something to look at.
Okay. I mean, the point that hopefully I'm trying to make is that there are, as we've evolved from single-celled organisms, we've unfortunately lost the ability to manufacture some biomolecules because in our environment it's very easy for us to digest and utilize other organisms. So there are essential chemicals that we simply cannot manufacture for precursors, and there's a lot of things that we're able to kind of make on our own. So probably the important thing is the essential molecules that we can't form. If we get those, then we have the ability to kind of disassemble everything else and manufacture whatever we need. So, it's an interesting topic. I'll look into it a little bit more. Again, I'm a little suspicious that there happens to be one particular plant that does it all, and there isn't a family of plants, but I'll see. I'll look it up.
No, thanks. I was just curious, to see if that, for what I heard, is true, or if there are other plants that, equally produce the same profile.
Again, I can't tell you for a fact, but I would be very surprised to find that soybeans are quite that unique. You know, soybeans didn't just kind of come into existence out of nowhere. There's a lot of cousins to it, and that they must have somewhat similar profiles. But again, I don't know, but I'll take a good look and see if that information is available.
PhD.
Yes, Jim.
I wasn't insinuating that the quinoa would make you healthy eating just that. Just that it was described as the only plant that you could eat only that and survive it. Like you said, you need a variation of things. So I just wanted to clarify that I wasn't trying to say you could be healthy that way, just that you could survive it.
Yeah, I understand, Jim. I just kind of giving people a more general overview. I'll keep on remembering some weird documentary about a guy in England who decided to see if he could live on potato chips. So he ate potato chips for a couple of years. He looked terrible.
I would imagine.
Was he crispy?
Yes, indeed. I assume so. They didn't go into detail. They probably shot some B-roll of him, chowing down. Because he was English, it wasn't chips. It was, I forget what the British call potato chips. Crisps. Yeah, they call them crisps. Anyway, we're kind of coming up to the minute, to 10:15 in a couple of minutes. If anyone has any closing comments, statements, questions, answers, what have you, we got a little bit more time, so you can take advantage of it.
This is Brian. I just want to thank everyone for all their information for me, and I really appreciate it. And, Roy, thank you most of all for leadership, and I'll be listening.
Well, you're quite welcome, Brian. And thank you for participating. Like I said before, no one has any questions. What are we doing here? So thank you. Thank everyone tonight. I hope you learned a few things, and I hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do this all over again. But it's coming close to the witching time, so I will summon Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet report.
Okay, Roy. We don't have that much, but a couple of space topics here. AC2GS WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. There's a school, university in Kentucky, and they did an experiment with the help of NASA. They wanted to build these spheres out of different metals and different materials to see how they would withstand reentry. The goal is to look for better materials to put on them, on heat shields as future spacecraft come through, flying through the atmosphere. So these five descent little modules, you know, maybe the size of a basketball in some case, they put them on to Cygnus spacecraft, maybe I guess around around April, and it went up to the Interstellar Space Station. Cygnus, you know, gets launched on a regular basis with supplies, not people, just supplies, go to the ISS, and they'll bring up, you know, like 8,000 pounds of stuff and experiments and clothes and stuff like that. Well, some of these experiments, like the school in Kentucky made, they attached them to the Cygnus spacecraft where, you know, they're actually attached and they're not brought into the space station. They remain attached for months on end, sometimes 4 or 5 months, and they unload everything from the Cygnus. But meanwhile, these are test experiments are still attached to the outside of Cygnus. They bring all the stuff in that they need to bring in, and then as the months go by, they load it up full of junk and things that they're going to get rid of because the Cygnus spacecraft eventually burns up over the South Pacific Ocean at some point. With that, they got to that point where time to separate the ISS from the Cygnus spacecraft, and they did that. And here are these five spheres still attached. They floated away, and they start to deorbit the Cygnus spacecraft to again go over the South Pacific to burn up. And as it started to do that, the accelerometers start to kick in because, you know, it starts to get hit the atmosphere, and there are sensors inside these experiments that the students made that turn the equipment on, start transmitting information and data, and they use the Iridium satellites to pick up the data. They didn't use a Starlink or anything like that. They actually use the Iridium satellites, and what happens is these five spheres separated from the Cygnus spacecraft. The Cygnus spacecraft went on to burn up over the South Pacific, and so did these things enter into the atmosphere and come flying through at 16,000 miles per hour at around 180,000 feet. It starts to accelerate, or the accelerometers kick in. It's actually deaccelerating. Heating up, they got up to their thermometers. They could tell the temperature inside. Got up to like 4,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And apparently they all survived. What they had was the professor that was involved with this. He's a professor of aeronautics and mechanical. He teaches this stuff. He was heavily involved with it. He was on one of the planes that was hired there. Actually, they flew out of Australia, and the plane was in the area when Cygnus came through the atmosphere over the South Pacific, along with these five spheres. And sure enough, they all survived. They get the data from the satellites from Iridium, and they call this thing the Creep 2, K-R-E-P-E, and they just named it after Kentucky Reentry Probe Experiment Number 2. There was a number 1 that they tried a year or so before, just to see if if the transmitters worked, they sent it up to the space station. But these were actual test units that they needed to see if they worked out. Sure enough, they did. And there's actually going to be a Creep 3. They'll do that in a couple of years. You know, more advanced, more testing. But this is what NASA does. They bring in the young people, which they really need. You know, if you look at ULA, the United Launch Alliance, and they say the average age now is like 40. You know, compared to the early days of the space program in the 70s when you had the average age was 27 years old at NASA when they first started. And the young people, you know, that's the future, and that's what they're doing. And it turns out every one of these things survived, and they got data back, and they'll probably be reviewing that data for months, if not years, to come. Anyway, before we move on, any comments? This is WS2N.
Paul, this is KE2AJU. How are you tonight?
Good evening, Charlie. How are you?
Doing good.
Listen to the net. Interesting topics all night long. And here we are, up to the space program. Back to you, Charlie.
Yeah, I got one question. On the spaceship 5, 6, and 7, they removed the heat shields from number 6. Can you please explain what NASA's theory is?
Yeah, you're talking about the Starship that SpaceX is going to be sending up, let's see, November. Come on, actually, let's see what's today. I think it's supposed to go tomorrow, right? This is the 18th. Yeah, today's the 17th. So they'll launch that schedule for it tomorrow afternoon. And that'll be the sixth experiment by SpaceX to launch the Starship. It's almost 400-foot long thing. It will launch from Boca Chica, Texas. And yeah, they're up to number 6. Not one of them has achieved orbit yet. Purposely, they don't want to put this Starship into orbit. The Starship itself is coming, you know, maybe almost 200 feet long, and they don't want to see it floating in orbit. If for any reason it can't deorbit itself, the idea would be to avoid having another Skylab incident. You know, that's what we had back in the 70s when Skylab came down. It was a gamble. They didn't know where it was going to land. They don't want that to happen with this. So they're waiting for an eventual test where they're going to relight the engine, and that's what they plan on doing with this test. They haven't done that yet successfully. They want to put it into a suborbital flight, even though it's going to land, you know, in the Indian Ocean. It's still not, you know, it's actually a suborbital trajectory. And before it does that, this time they plan on relighting that engine. If they can prove they can relight that engine, they might even relight 3 engines. They'll be able to say to themselves, okay, that works. So on ship number 7, we're going to send that up, and we'll, when 7 goes up, they'll probably put that one into orbit for the first time. But the heat shield removal, they're not taking all the tiles off, a lot of them, thousands of tiles, in areas that they believe that is not getting that hot when it comes to the atmosphere. Drop it. There you are, leaving the ones on that do get hot. So, you know, through the other flights, they've already I got enough data to figure out that certain areas, well, we just don't need all these files, and they're only going to add weight to the rocket and rocketry. The goal is to eliminate as much weight as possible. You think back to the first shuttle that went up, 1984, when that thing went up, it looked at the pictures of the original shuttle, the whole external tank, the ET tank, of the space shuttle, which contained all the liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen for the three engines, the three RS-25 engines. That big tank, you looked at beautiful pictures, it was all white. Wow, the whole thing was all white. And then future launches, you look, actually the second one was also white, but all those, the rest of the space shuttle launches, which was another 132 launches, all were orange looking. That was the color of the insulation. The reason the first one and two were white is because they wanted to, to do this. Let's paint it. They painted the whole thing white, and they figured out that added, just the paint itself on that big tank, added 600 pounds to the space shuttle. Well, if you could get rid of 600 pounds, that means you could bring up, 600 pounds more of stuff, oxygen or water or people or something. But, imagine, that's how big these vehicles are. Imagine painting something and the paint itself weighs 600 pounds. Well, same thing with these tiles. They're probably going to save a couple thousand pounds that will be able to be used for a future payload. Anyway, back to you, Charlie. WS2N.
If they can take 2,000 pounds worth of tiles off, that's a phenomenal amount of weight.
Yeah, and that might be more than that. I don't know. I forget how many tiles, but I read it. But a good, quite a bit of it, on the upper part of the vehicle, they're just going to leave the ones, on the belly of it. When it comes through, it's going to do a belly flop coming in. So that's all going to stay. Now, they have reinforced the ones that are there. They under the existing tiles, they've now put another insulating material. Some kind of almost like a blanket type of material that they rolled out and attached to the stainless steel skin. And they by the way, they use stainless steel on their vehicle, where most, if not all, most of the ones I can think of are all aluminum alloys, not stainless. Anyway, that's what they're doing. Back to you, Charlie.
I think that's a good idea to remove those tiles, if you can, and still be safe.
Even the shuttle, when they had tiles, on the belly and on the wings, then up near the sides, the original shuttles had tiles creeping up the side, but they removed them, and they had some type of insulating blanket that was attached to the upper part of the space shuttles. So, they have NASA to go by. NASA did all these things years ago. SpaceX is doing this on their own. By the way, it's not a NASA thing. NASA is not controlling how SpaceX builds this vehicle. They let them build it, and NASA will either approve something or not approve something before they allow a NASA experiment to go up on any of these vehicles. Back to you, Charlie.
Okay, now there was one other question I had. Up to now, I mean this year, they have 212 launches this year. You think they're going to still go strong for the rest of the year?
Oh, I forgot how many they've done. You're saying that they've gotten up to 200. No, I don't think so. 200 this year. Maybe worldwide. But SpaceX is probably... Oh, I just read it. Oh, yeah, it's over 100. Yeah, I think it's 120 or something like that, 130. But, yeah, they have probably a dozen launches left for the end of this month and December. You know, they're doing an average of two or three a week. And most of them are for themselves, you know, for the Starlink satellites they keep launching. You know, don't know if they have any more government missions planned for the year, for the end of this year. So yeah, and they also launch for, you know, for different countries have different satellites that they would like to put up, and SpaceX will get the contracts for that. But, you know. We'll see. Next year should be very busy as well, because not only SpaceX, all these other companies are starting to come online, including Blue Origin. They really plan on launching before the end of the year. They're a massive New Glenn vehicle that's going to be that's bigger than the Falcon 9, twice as powerful as the Falcon 9. With 3.9 million pounds of thrust, Falcon 9 has. I think they're up to 1.7, so almost twice the thrust. So, you know, that thing's going to go on its first launch probably in December. The booster itself is going to come back and land on a drone ship, their own drone ship, named Jacqueline. He named it after his mother. And the thing is, that drone ship, by the way, is probably 1.5 times the size of what SpaceX is using. It's a big drone ship. If that's successful, it'll be a big thing, because it'll be the first time anybody launches a big vehicle like that, heavy lift vehicle, and is able to not only capture it successfully, but reuse it in the future. Charlie, back to you.
Yes, tonight, I watched tonight's launch, and it took 8 minutes from the time the ship and the rocket left the launch pad until the rocket was recovered back down on a barge. 8 minutes today.
Yeah, that's standard for those launches. And by the way, it usually takes about 8 minutes for all these rockets to get to orbit. You know, they go up on the first stage. The first stage usually burns out after two and a half minutes. Then the second stage kicks in. The first stage, either if it's an expendable vehicle, you know, just winds up going into Davy Jones's locker in the Atlantic, or, you know, the second stage always continues on. So, yeah, that's standard. It's been like that, you know, since the beginning of rocketry for orbital flights, you know, when the Saturn V launched, the Saturn V engines would kick off after about 8 minutes. Next stage would take off. Same holds true for the Falcon 9, and will also hold true for the Starship, the one that is going to, you know, that is going to come back and land, get caught by the arms at the launch complex where it first took off, which they've already succeeded in doing. They're going to do that again, by the way, tomorrow. If they launch that booster will come back and be caught by those big arms on the launch complex in Texas. But, you know, eight minutes is the standard number. You take the new rocket, the Vulcan rocket by the ULA. ULA is United Launch Alliance. it's actually two companies, Lockheed Martin and Boeing. They comprise of the ULA. And that rocket, the first stage, goes a little, you know, the high end of 8 minutes before the first stage cuts off, and the second stage kicks in. That's why there's no chance of, no plans of creating a reusable vehicle out of the Vulcan first stage, because that one takes it pretty much to orbit. It's going way too fast for them to recover. The engineering behind that would be a little tougher. So that's an expendable rocket. From day one, they planned on that. But ULA knows that the most important part of the vehicle is the engines themselves, not the booster itself, but the engines. For the ULA, they're using the engines that are built by Blue Origin. Blue Origin supplies them these methane, liquid oxygen. They call them BE-4 engines. And their plan in the future, it might be, you know, a couple of years down the road, I think that I read about two or three years from now, they'll be able to recover those engines. And the way they're going to do it is they'll need some kind of a heat shield. So first they have to figure out how to separate the engines from the booster itself, let the booster, you know, just burn up in the atmosphere. But they want those engines back. They're planning on using a inflatable heat shield that NASA has already tested. They tested a smaller version. I think it was roughly 20 feet in diameter. The thing would inflate with nitrogen, and it was, you know, it came flying through the atmosphere, and it worked perfectly. No marks on it, no char marks. Worked great. So they plan on eventually doing that. They'll have that setup attached to the engine section of the rocket. This thing will inflate and eventually come back and be floating down on the ocean. The hover boat go over, pick them up, and at some point they'll be able to, you know, check it out and reuse those expensive, well-built engines being built by Blue Origin. Charlie, back to you.
Yeah, those Falcon rockets are reusable. I believe they're up over 300. The rocket that went up tonight was used over 300 times.
Yeah, the most they've gotten out of the launches is 20. But, you know, they've built a number of these boosters. So, you know, they're now over 300 launches that they have successfully launched. And then I guess close to that amount that they've also landed successfully on the drones, or landed back at the Cape, or they've been launched from Vandenberg, California as well. So they either land on a drone ship out in the Pacific, or they come back and land back at Vandenberg. Let me just stand by a second. Frank wants to get in from Echo Link. Let me just stand by for a second. WS2M.
Yeah, very good. WBTBXO here. Yeah, I watched the live stream earlier this evening also. It is hard to believe that we're thinking of reusability as we SpaceX does for their commercial vehicles is being routine now. In the Apollo era, when NASA was asked about reusability, you know, that's just not possible. There's even a Young Sheldon episode about that, which is rather funny. For those who are fans of the show, yeah, I think they did say that they've done 120 launches this year. Their target was 148, and they're probably going to make it to 140, if I remember correctly from the live stream tonight. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good, Frank. Yeah, that's a big number. And, wow. Yeah, the launch that they, you know, what they have tonight, was it something special or just more Starlinks, Frank?
They had TB7 satellites going up tonight.
WB2BXO. Again, nobody knows, apparently what they explained was nobody actually knows what the TD or TD7 is. Apparently it's a confidential or secret payload being launched for, I think they said the Australians, and nobody knows what seems to know, at least publicly, what the acronym stands for. That was not a Starlink launch. It was some kind of intelligence or possibly proprietary satellite. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah, either a spy satellite or an experimental satellite by a company that they don't want anybody to know what it is. Steal their secrets. Okay. Yeah, and there's going to be a lot of competition. There's one company, Stoke. It's called Stoke Space, and they're working on complete reusability. Right now, Falcon 9 goes up. Yeah, the boosters are all reusable, but second stages are not. They all, you know, refire their engines and burn up in the atmosphere. This company, Stoke, they're working on the first stage and the second stage. Their main focus was on the second stage for the last couple of years. They got pretty far with that. It's an interesting design. The heat shield, you know, for the second stage, it has to have a heat shield to do that. It's coming through at 17,000 miles an hour. So it does need that, you know, to have a heat shield that's completely reusable. You know, they found a way around it. They're taking the fuel, in this case it's liquid hydrogen, and they have a series of what's called piping near the heat shield. So you have a heat shield on top of the heat shield. You know, you can't see it. There's going to be this piping, and essentially, like elements, heater elements, you know, strewn across the bottom of the thing, so that, you know, as it's coming back through the atmosphere, you know, you need rocket engines to slow it down. They're not going to use parachutes. So here's this thing flying through on a propulsive trajectory, and here's a heat shield that's going to be cooled by the movement of the fuel, the cold liquid hydrogen. And liquid hydrogen is feeding these rockets. They're going to have 30 rockets on the bottom of the Stoke rocket, and these engines will be firing, trying, you know, helping to slow it down as it's coming through the atmosphere. And at the same time, it will be cooling the heat shield. So it's a really unique design. I saw a nice interview with this company one time. It was pretty good. And hopefully they'll be able to get their first launch off, you know, what they said, I think, probably the end of 2025 or maybe beginning of 2026. And the first stage, of course, is a plan to be reusable as well. So that's Stokes Space. Let me drop it. And there's a couple more. There's Miara. That's a company by a Spanish company. They plan on building reusable rockets. You have Peter Beck. He's in charge of. He's the owner of Rocket Lab. They're the ones that launch Electron, and he's building the Neutron rocket, which is all going to be 3D carbon made. You know, it's carbon fiber. And he's well into developing that, and I expect possible launch next year, test launch sometime next year, maybe late next year, of the Neutron rocket. And again, that one is going to be completely reusable as well. That's an interesting design. The whole rocket goes up, you know, first stage. Brings you all the way up, and then the fairings, usually, you know, on all these vehicles, the fairings open up and they spring away from the vehicle, and the fairings usually burn up in the atmosphere, or in SpaceX's case, the fairings come flying down and on parachutes, paragliding, and they recover those and reuse them. You got to remember these fairings, some of these things are like, you know, six stories tall, you know, they're big things that encapsulate the usually the payloads. Well, on the Neutron rocket, you know, the fairing is going to open up, and the second stage will be inside the fairing, along with the payload itself. So envision this rocket going up, like I said, roughly about 8 minutes before the engines shut off. Engines shut down, fairings open up, and out comes the second stage. Second stage reignites, and you know, it's like a kicker stage. Now that will put it into its orbit, where, you know, go on to its mission. The fairings, like I said, it just hinge open. They were going to have like four fairings, you know, but they switched to two. So these two fairings will, you know, open up like a big alligator's mouth. Let out this second stage, and then they're going to close back down again, and now it'll look like one big rocket, like it looked before it took off. It'll then re-enter the atmosphere like that, and eventually come back and land that way, you know, probably on a drone ship, or maybe back at, you know, wherever they launch from. And that one has landing legs and things. It's not going to be caught, you know, out of the midair like what SpaceX is doing. That will actually come down and land on a solid surface. A lot of things, you know, there's more rockets too. You know, reusability is going to be the name of the game, that's for sure. Any comments? WS to us.
Paul, got a question.
Yeah, 1 second. No, let me, I thought I heard Frank again. Let me stand by a second, Charlie. WB2BXO, WS2N.
Yeah, Paul, I actually didn't try to get in there, but I do have a comment here that Starship, when fully operational, is supposed to be fully reusable also. And at the second stage, the Starship vehicle is supposed to be able to come back and either be caught or land. So I don't know how, nobody knows how soon they're going to do that, but the intent of the design is for Starship to be totally reusable also. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's right. they plan on putting people on that too, Frank, right? So, yeah, that's got to come back down in one piece. Wow. Imagine putting astronauts on that thing. That, you know, you have to deorbit and flying through You know, I mean, we did it with the shuttle, but SpaceX is not NASA, you know? Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, the shuttle, I think some people would say the shuttle is refurbishable, not really rapidly reusable, because it'll replace the heat shield or a lot of it and do an awful lot of servicing before you could actually reuse the thing. But depends on your definition. By the way, there is a really fascinating story about the shuttle heat shield. Is apparently after Columbia, NASA decided they wanted somebody to sew thermal blankets around the shuttle. So what they did was they hired a young woman who was a championship quilter who was also fascinated with the space program, and she sewed thermal quilts for them to put around the space shuttle as part of the heat shield. A very fascinating story. It's on YouTube somewhere. Go ahead.
Yeah, that's probably the thermal blankets I mentioned earlier that were on the side, up near, like, where the windows were. You could see it. And sometimes the shuttle came back, it looked like it was all, like wrinkled a little bit in that area. That's probably the area. I wouldn't be surprised if that's what they were talking about. They were definitely thermal blankets.
Yeah, I just thought it was a fascinating story. Who would ever expect a combination of skills and interests like that to result in a truly unique job? I just thought that, you know, that was a kind of amazing story. Supposedly is doing some consulting on the Starship heat shield also. And I had actually tried to ask her about it online. She said she's not allowed to discuss it, but it wouldn't surprise me. But apparently she's involved in that project also to some extent.
Okay, that's great. Very good. So she's been around a while. The early shuttle days, and now Starship. Wow. Yeah, now Starship's got, shuttle came down and landed like an airplane. You know, it had wheels. Starship is coming down, and it's going to be caught by these magic arms that, what do they call them? Chopsticks, you know? Yeah, could you imagine being a crew member? Yeah, you're coming down. You better hope. Cross your fingers and count your lucky stars that this thing is going to be caught properly. So I think we're a long way from putting a crew on board. But, you know, I mean, I guess somewhere down the road they will be doing that. Very good. And I know Charlie wanted to say something else. So over to you, Charlie. AJ, you go ahead. WS2N.
Yeah, that new satellite that went up tonight, TV-7, that is so you can transmit MRIs over the airwaves instead of the computer. And it's a brand new concept to me. Wow.
In other words, the bandwidth is going to be so high that you can transmit the equivalent of a MRI or an actual MRI. Okay. I don't know. It's a step in the right direction, I guess. We'll see. There was a couple of other rocket companies I was going to mention, too, that plan on being reusable. But there's one that was planning on being reusable called Skylon. that has now come to a grinding halt. Skylon has been around for almost 35 years, and they planned on it was going to actually take off on a runway, and the idea was to get up to like Mach 6, like 5 or 6 times the speed of sound, hypersonic, and then switch over to a rocket engine and go to orbit that way. Not that they were going to switch engines. They were going to use the same engines. They were called Sabre engines. Synergetic. I don't know. I wrote it down somewhere. I forgot. But anyway, the engines themselves would be using liquid hydrogen, and they would be getting the oxygen from the air, just like a jet plane. And as they got up to speed, these engines were able to instantly cool down the temperatures where they'd actually be able to use the same engines and switch over to the liquid oxygen that's on board the Skylon vehicle. So the company that was doing the engines, Reaction Engines was the name of the company. They started off in England, were funded by the English companies over there, and then eventually they set up shop in Colorado here, and they've been testing this engine in Colorado probably the last 5 or 6 years. So now apparently they went broke. They don't have enough money. They laid off the 140 people that were working for them. But it was a good idea. Maybe somebody down the road will pick up on this Sabre engine. We'll see. But the Skylon vehicle, was based around this. So that's now come to a grinding halt. That would have been great. Take off on a runway with wheels and everything. Go to space and come back one piece. No second stage. No nothing. And I remember reading about that, 30 years ago, saying, "Oh, that's going to be great." And they tried, but so far, no good. Any comments?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of talk about the so-called SSTO, single stage to orbit, and I think some of the aerospace people just don't think SSTO is very feasible. WB2BXO.
Yeah, a lot of plans, but they never made it. What was the other one? They were going to use aerospike engines on that one. Venture Star. They were going to build this thing. I mean, it was a massive thing. Like, it looked like a triangular shape, very wide base, and they had these aerospike engines. And if they could have gotten the engines to work, maybe they could have gotten somewhere. They would use these engines to be able to go through the atmosphere without worrying about, the efficiency of the engines. They would have been like 100% efficient all the way up, where you can't really have that with regular engines. You'll notice on the bottom of, for instance, the bottom of Starship, you have 3 regular nozzles coming out, and then you have these big nozzles coming out of the engines. The engines are the same. They're all Raptor engines. But why do they have these big nozzles? And the big nozzles have to do with when they get high up, they're called vacuum capable. So they work in a vacuum. And then to have that efficiency, they have these gigantic valves on it to do that. In the lower atmosphere, pressure's there. You don't need this big bell around it, but you don't have that pressure when you get high up. And they need to contain that where it doesn't go off to the side.
Complete.
You would lose for your thrust, and the aerospike engine was designed to compensate for that. Instead of having the thrust was inside of a cone, was inside of a nozzle like that, it was like an inverted thing. You would have the thrust was exterior. You know, it's hard to describe. It's like having the, you know, if you took a nozzle, cut it in half, and then have the thrust come down, you just took part, half the nozzle off, that would be the equivalent of an aerospike engine. In theory, it would work, and if they could get it to work on a small scale, they said it would be very easy to scale up to a large-scale vehicle. So, venture thought never made it. Any comments before 11 o'clock? Before we close, WS2S.
AC2GS. Paul, what do you think of Mars Link?
Yeah, I heard that years ago. My brother was telling me about it. They wanted to put the equivalent of all our satellites, all Starlink satellites. They want to do the same thing for Mars and screw up that planet as well. Back to you.
Yeah, apparently it would have the smallest intranet known to mankind, zero.
I heard this years ago, and I guess that's back in the news again. They're going to have a lot of satellites for the moon, but it's not the same deal. But they will have a lot of satellites to, you know, for any land operations on the moon. But, if they do it, it's going to be a long time from now, right?
I would agree. It's a wonderful example, though, of putting the cart before the horse, though.
KD2VHD.
KD2VHD. Go ahead. WS2S.
Hello. Very interesting. I'm curious. Any thoughts on the, I think they call it D2C, direct to cell phone from the satellite? That's a thing that's being talked about. Is it a thing? Is it not a thing? Is it... Any thoughts?
SpaceX is experimenting with it on their latest satellites. They say they have that capability on the newest Starlink. The Kuiper satellites being built by Blue Origin, they're supposed to have that capability as well. They launched two satellites as an experiment, Blue Origin. And they did an experiment, and one girl was in some island, I guess in the Pacific, and they made a cell phone, regular cell phone contact with somebody that was in Italy. So, that was a couple of years ago. But he has yet to put his constellation up yet. There's dozens of flights that are planned by New Glenn to do that, and also by the Vulcan rocket, the Vulcan rocket. They plan on doing many launches with that. And then Jeff Bezos also has a contract with India. I believe they got on a list as well as Ariane, the European Space Agency. His goal is to get over 3,000 satellites up there in a hurry. He's got to do it by a certain year for some reason. It has something to do with a contract or something. I don't know. But, Jim, back to you.
So is this just an anecdotal thing, or is it a communications-changing thing?
If you want to sign up with their, after they're successful with this, instead of signing up with your local carrier, whatever it is, I'd be signing up, I guess, with Jeff Bezos, with Kuiper, and